Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many things that will improve our mental and physical health. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals of many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, for everybody out there, I'm looking for some show ambassadors. I would love to have people who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and someone that you know that can benefit from a particular subject. And I think this is one of those subjects that I think we probably all know somebody that could benefit from it. Now, I want everybody to know that I truly appreciate this, and this is just another way that we, as a group, can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, considering some of the negative aspects of what's been going on in our schools, our topic today is PTSD in youth. And I can't believe that that's going on. As I've shared before, hosting this show has become a great source of knowledge for me. And that was proven once again when I learned that nearly 20% of youth and 30% of adults develop PTSD following a life-threatening or traumatic event. Now, to talk about this subject, our guest, Dr. Michael S. Scaringa, is professor and vice chair of research for psychology at Tulane University School of Medicine. Dr. Scaringa has spent over 23 years researching, treating, and teaching about stress, trauma, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Michael founded a public clinic, Child Counseling Associates. He started the Kid Catch Foundation and previously published a guide on PTSD for clinicians, as well as dozens of scientific articles on this very misunderstood topic. And he also gives lectures and training around the United States and internationally. Now, he is also the author of the book that I have just gone through and learned quite a bit. It's entitled, They'll Never Be the Same, A Parent's Guide to PTSD in Youth and Treating PTSD in Preschoolers, a Clinical Guide. In this book and on our show today, Michael demystifies issues associated with this diagnosis. He debunks myths and provides valuable direction on navigating the confusing maze of the mental health world to find appropriate care. Michael, thanks again for joining us here on Answers for the Family.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I think to kind of jump right into it, when we're talking about trauma, I think that many people think of some things that we hear about in the news or very specific things, but I know that there's much more than that. But you know, what are some of the most common types of trauma children are subject to today?
Yeah, we usually think of PTSD with adults like military combat, but unfortunately, children can experience a lot of different traumas, such as physical abuse, sexual abuse, witnessing domestic violence against their mothers, motor vehicle accidents is common, other types of injuries and maybe burns. For small children, being attacked by a large dog can be a life-threatening experience. And of course, then there's natural disasters, man-made disasters, and unfortunately, things like school shootings now.
Yeah. Well, in the introduction, I mentioned some of the percentages of cases where trauma leads to PTSD. Are there different percentages for different types of trauma?
That's a difficult thing to study, but we have, you know, some guidelines to think that there are certain types of things that are more likely to cause PTSD than others just because of their severity. You know, things like rape is a much more personal and threatening thing than perhaps a natural disaster. Burns seem to be a particularly toxic type of trauma because they have the after effects of dealing with this skin grafts and surgeries and the physical manifestations. But besides that, it's hard to say that one is worse than the other. You know, you might think motor vehicle accidents is kind of a single blow, kind of simple kind of trauma, but that's not. People have to ride in cars every day afterwards, and that can be something that triggers them. So I think a good rule of thumb is, you know, about 30% for all types of traumas, people will develop PTSD.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that most of us think of this as, military people coming back from combat. And yes, that's what we've been told. But why do you believe that PTSD is so under-recognized in children?
Yeah, something we talk about in the book is that they've done two studies that showed that licensed clinicians miss the diagnosis of PTSD 90% of the time in people. I think there's several reasons for that. One is the avoidance issue. People don't want to talk about traumatic experiences. They can be embarrassing and shameful, and they're not going to bring them up spontaneously. So people have to ask the right questions. And I think clinicians have some avoidance because they don't want to upset their clients by asking about things like this. Another issue is that a lot of these symptoms of PTSD are what we call internalized. That means they're thoughts or feelings that are going on inside a person, and there's not something you can observe from the outside. You know, we can all look at maybe a person with hyperactivity and attention deficit and see that, but we can't see PTSD symptoms just by looking at them. And then another issue is it's just complicated. There's 20 different symptoms of PTSD. One PTSD does not look like the next PTSD. And I think one researcher counted up the number of different ways you can actually have the diagnosis based on the 20 symptoms, and it came to over 600,000 different ways to have the
wow.
meet the diagnostic criteria.
Well, I mean, that brings up the question of, I mean, two things. I mean, one is, you know, I mean, how in most cases does it show up in our lives, and what can we do? If you're saying that clinicians, people who are trained to be able to assist in these areas, if they're missing it 90% of the time, what can we do differently in the training so that it is spotted and it is dealt with?
The specific symptoms are those 20 different symptoms that are in the official criteria. And we think about them in three clusters, three different types of symptoms. One type we call the re-experiencing. Those are things like nightmares or intrusive thoughts that barge into a person's head that they don't want there. The second type we call the numbing and avoidance symptoms. A person will lose interest in things they used to like to do. They'll avoid being around loved ones, and you'll see them withdraw. And then the third type we call the increased arousal. Those are things like difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping, or exaggerated startle responses. And what we can do to identify those better is you have to just ask the questions. And clinicians don't always do that, as I was saying earlier. So one of the messages of the book that I'm making is for parents, it's kind of up to you. You have to take charge to some degree of recognizing these. You can download free checklists. You can go to my website, download free questionnaires. You can fill them out yourselves about your children, or if your children are old enough, you can have them take it. Now, usually professionals don't say you should do self-diagnosis, but I'm saying you need to do self-diagnosis to some degree in this situation because the ball's in your court to detect it.
Now, can you share what your website is? And for those of you driving, obviously, you know, you can't write this down, but for everybody else operating off of your computer, please take this down. You may not be thinking about it right now, but something may occur in your life, and you'll think about it and go, wait, I need to go and get that checklist.
Yeah, it's if you just do a, like a Google search on Scaringa Lab, and Scaringa is spelled Scheringa, and that'll take you to my site, and you'll see links to measures and questionnaires.
All right. And again, and for those of you that didn't get a chance to write that down and are going to try to think about how to spell that later, you can always go to our website. You go to the answersforthefamily.com website. We will have all of his information up so that you will be able to reach him. When you were mentioning in regards to, as far as clinicians and parents trying to identify this, and obviously with children is what we're focusing on, so many times I know that in working with teenagers, the response to whatever their type of acting out is or whatever it is that they're going through is, oh, well, this is just raging hormones, or this is just what it means to be a teenager. And it sounds like what you're saying is in many cases that might not be.
Right. I mean, we start off in the book with an interesting case of a teenage boy who had been misdiagnosed for years. He was acting up. He was expelled from school. He was diagnosed with oppositional behavior and attention deficit hyperactivity. But nobody, and he'd been to therapists, and he'd been treated with counseling and medications. But nobody had asked him about his past experiences of trauma. And by luck, he got to our clinic, and we recognized his trauma history and found out he had witnessed domestic violence and he had been physically abused. And once we got him into the right kind of treatment for the trauma-related symptoms, that's what turned the corner for him.
Now, what about more, some of the things that are, from a psychological trauma standpoint, like abandonment? Because I know that we work with quite a few young people that have been adopted, so they've gone through part of the system, that has a government system that has sort of bounced them around sometimes before they've ended up being placed with a particular family. How much of that do you think is the trauma that they've gone through in dealing with that? Because by the time we see them, oftentimes they're now acting out. Has there been any studies that tie directly to that?
Yeah, what counts as trauma is a tricky question. We use the word trauma for almost anything. You could say, I was stuck in a traffic jam coming to work. I'm traumatized by that. But that's not the kind of trauma that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. The kind of trauma that tends to cause PTSD is these life-threatening experiences that are usually, they're sudden, they're unexpected, and a person has this intense moment of panic that they're going to die. Then there's all sorts of other things in life that we call stress that aren't necessarily trauma. Those can be things like abandonment, emotional abuse, parents getting divorced, watching violence on TV. Those are bad things, and they're stressful, but they don't tend to lead to PTSD. Now, it gets tricky because a child could have abandonment, and in that experience of abandonment, maybe there was a specific moment where that child did fear for his life, but it would have to be a specific type of life-threatening event within that abandonment experience of fearing for his life that would be the type that would lead to PTSD.
Well, we have a question that's coming in, and again, I want to thank those that take the time to send these questions in either ahead of the show because you received the press release, or those that are sending them in like this where you're either emailing them or instant messaging them in. But this one refers directly to, we're talking about teens, and it says, personally, I never hear about PTSD in teens. I mainly hear about it only in military veterans. And I've also now starting to hear that stressed out seems to be the term that is used for the rest of us. Can you explain, what the difference is? By the way, I have downloaded your book on Kindle and I'm looking forward to recommending it to our team of counselors at our high school. And this is from June in Arizona.
Well, thanks for the question. Well, they've done good like epidemiology research and shown that, I think you may have mentioned this, 2/3 of children in the United States by the age of 16 have experienced at least one life-threatening type of event. And that's amazing when we think about it. Now, most of them do not develop PTSD from that, but it just goes to show that trauma is a common part of our life. The reason we probably don't hear about it as much is, one, it has been relatively unrecognized. You know, PTSD was just formally recognized for adults around 1980, and historically there's been resistance to recognize that children might have PTSD too. Children tend to lag behind adults, usually in terms of psychiatric disorders being recognized. But I think it's growing, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because, as I said, the diagnosis is missed most of the time, and instead of relying on clinicians to get that word out, I decided, you know, I've got to get the word out straight to the parents with a book like this.
Well, I mean, I know, as someone who goes to a lot of brain seminars and such, you know, I do hear of people talking about research. You know, they'll say, well, you know, there's research data on this subject. But it sounds like what you're saying is maybe much of this research data is maybe being misinterpreted. And if so, how?
Well, there is some of it that's being misinterpreted. You know, one of the things, if we want to talk about, is brain abnormalities and brain imaging, and the idea of whether stress and trauma damages a person's brain. I think that's one of the misinformation pieces that's out there, saying that trauma damages people's brains. There's problems with that research, and that it's what we call cross-sectional, and that people's brains have always been studied after the traumatic events, so the researchers don't know what the brains look like before the traumatic events. They're just, you know, speculating that trauma causes differences. When newer, modern types of studies are done, where they've actually studied persons' brains before trauma and then again after, they're finding consistently that those brain differences were there before the traumatic events. And those brain differences probably explain why those people were vulnerable to develop PTSD. It's not that the trauma changed their brain, it's that they had different brains beforehand.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I think that at one point I heard it explained as, you know, that, you know, we're setting new pathways in our brain constantly, and that the trauma, you know, will set an inaccurate pathway. But yet I've gone to other things where it said, well, you know, it really takes repetition, you know, to do that, that the one incident, you know, shouldn't do that. So, you know, here I'm going to different things and I'm hearing two different arguments that are really countering each other. So I appreciate the way that you've explained it.
Yeah. And, you know, fair advertising, I'll say the way I'm presenting it is not the way most of the people are talking about it in the field right now. Most of the people are talking about it the way you're hearing it in seminars, that they believe that trauma damages the brain. But I don't think they're up to date on the more recent research that shows the differences were there beforehand.
There you go, folks. We're getting some cutting-edge stuff. Now, from the standpoint of dealing with children, and I'm always trying to be focused on the show with what can we do to improve things, or in this case, what are the best kinds of treatment that can be done for children and for those parents out there that are listening, or those professionals that are listening, thinking, you know, what are some of the things that maybe aren't being done that can now be done?
There are specific types of treatment you want to look for if you're a parent who's in the process of trying to find treatment for your child. But it's difficult. I mean, the short story is you want to look for what we call evidence-based treatments, where they've been studied rigorously, usually in randomized clinical trials. The best studied one is called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And when you go to a therapist, you should be asking that kind of question. It's kind of awkward to challenge doctors or therapists to ask them questions like this that you should ask. Have you ever seen a case like my child before? What kind of treatment are you recommending to do? Do you do cognitive behavioral therapy? Can you describe to me what that is and how you're going to do that? And there's all sorts of other therapies out there that people do, and it's not necessarily evidence-based. One thing I commonly say is, unfortunately, we have more information about the shingles on our roofs and the cereal on our breakfast table than we have about the therapists and mental health professionals out there, because there's just no quality rating system for consumers to use to know who's good and who's not.
Well, and I think that's a great point, and because I know that, again, and with many of the seminars, I mean, there are now people out there that are specializing in CBD. So
right,
so that may be the thing too, is that before you're choosing, as far as sitting in their office choosing, maybe the things that you can do in this day and age, we're now in the thing where you can Google up and go, okay, who are the people that are certified, in CBT in this geographical area, and maybe start there. Does that sound like the way to go?
That's a good way to start. Asking around, word of mouth, unfortunately, is the best way to find good therapists in whatever city you live in. Ask your pediatrician. It's hard to ask neighbors about something like this, but pediatricians are usually good. You'll hear about other therapies. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, or EMDR, can be a good one. What's practiced mostly out in the community is what would be called psychodynamic therapy or play therapy for younger children. That might be what works for your child, and that's what most therapists are going to do, is a kind of a psychodynamic or a play therapy instead of a CBT style. And if that's what you get, then maybe you can start on that path, but you should be watching closely. If your child's not getting better after 4, 5, 6 weekly sessions, then maybe it's time to switch horses.
Sounds good. So for everybody out there listening, we are talking about PTSD in youth, and we are talking with Dr. Michael S. Scaringa. Stay with us. We're going to take a break. You are listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. And our subject today is PTSD in youth. And actually, while we were on the break, an email came in with a question from someone who's listening that says, my child is scared to go to school after watching television and seeing these shootings that have gone on. What do you think I can tell my child to make them feel more secure and more comfortable in going back to school?
Well, one thing I want to let you know about is I just, on Saturday, after the Santa Fe High School shooting, posted a blog with 16 tips for talking with children after a school shooting. And you can go to psychologytoday.com and look on my name, and you'll find it. It depends on each situation. If you're this listener has a child who's already worried and refusing to go to school. So it sounds like we're talking about a safety issue. And one of the most common things you'll read on the internet about what to say to children is to try to tell them that, to reassure them that they're safe by telling them things like, you know, school shootings are rare. It's not going to happen at your school. Or your school is probably going to increase their security because of what just happened at this other school. I don't think that's necessarily the right thing to say to children. I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, but this child already knows that a shooting at the school is possible. They just watched it on TV. They just watched it at another school where the students believed it couldn't possibly happen at their school. So it's kind of like the cat is out of the bag, that it is possible. And children don't really want to know the odds. They want to know what to do in case something does happen. So I would suggest saying, hey, yeah, it is scary, but let's talk about what would you do? What's the plan if something scary happens?
Okay. And you know, I'd like to add to that a little bit. And for those that are regular listeners to the show, you may know that we had Elon Stevie on, who is a specialist in dealing with these types of things from an investigative standpoint. And he has a contract now with the Department of Homeland Security to be able to go out and to better train school staff and the law enforcement that work within that school or within that area. And he has a lot of things that he's doing that are not only helping to identify these things before they would happen, but also to be able to, if something does happen, to be able to cause it to end as quickly as possible. And I said it when he was on the show, and I'll say it again to any of the parents out there. Go to your school and ask them if they haven't done this yet, if they haven't got this type of training, do it. It's not coming out of your school budget. Homeland Security has already agreed to fund it, so it's just taking the time to set it up. And he brought up a great point when he was on the show, and that was, you know, throughout the school year, we do whatever it is, you know, 2, 3, 4 fire drills. But when's the last time there was a major fire in a school? But yet these things are happening, and yet they don't want to do a drill for it, you know, to be able to better prepare people for it. So that's one of the things that I want to add is that, yes, it's great to be able to now learn and understand what are some of the things we can do after a child's gone through trauma. But let's also be proactive, you know, as parents and teachers or administrators, to see what we can do ahead of time so that it doesn't happen again.
That's a good point. Like, I can imagine schools would not want to do drills because they think it might make their students nervous.
Exactly.
Students already know that it's possible. You're not planting ideas in students' heads by having a drill, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, one of the things that I mentioned in the beginning of the show is that there are some myths. Share with us what some of the myths are about children and trauma and ones that are accurate and ones that aren't.
Well, one is we kind of touched on earlier is for a long time people have refused to believe that children could remember enough to have PTSD, you know, or could remember enough to know that they had been traumatized. And we know that children can remember things about their lives and develop PTSD from about the age of 3. Those are the youngest reported cases, and I actually specialize in these younger 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds. They have all the skills at that point that they need, you know, verbal skills, memory skills, to remember what's happened to them. And if you all think back on your personal lives, what's the youngest memory you have about your own life? And it's probably around the age of 4 or 5, and it's probably something negative that happened. That's when we can start remembering. Another one of the myths that come up a lot is about parenting. I'd like to address that one a little bit. You know, unfortunately, our field of psychiatrists and psychologists has been unfortunately bad about blaming parents for their children's problems. You know, in the 1950s, our field blamed parents for autism. And in the 1960s, they blamed parents for schizophrenia. You know, they called the refrigerator mothers as the ones who caused these things. And now we know that that's not true, that autism and schizophrenia arise because of genetics, mostly. But that parent-blaming phenomenon is not just isn't going to die, and it keeps looking for new things to blame. And PTSD, unfortunately, is one of those, where parents often get blamed for the children's PTSD because the parents weren't sensitive enough or warm enough. And I want to tell parents that that's just not the case. Parents can be really important for helping their children get over things and helping children in therapy. But if you're in a situation with a therapist, with your child in therapy, and you're feeling blamed by the therapist for your child's problems, you need to push back on that.
Okay, and we have another listener question that's coming in right now. This one reads, my 10-year-old daughter was followed and asked to get into a van of a man. Fortunately, she, as we've told her in the past, ran home. Our issue now is she doesn't like to be alone in public. What can we do to get her to feel less, and they have in quotes, traumatized?
So one thing I would want to ask is, how long has this been going on? I think if it's within the first month after that happened, that's a pretty normal reaction and good judgment to stay safe. If it's been more than a month since that event happened and she's still afraid to go out, it may be time to seek professional help. There's good evidence that says after traumatic events, probably 100% of us will have some PTSD symptoms. But for most of us, the symptoms go away after about 1 month. And those who are going to have long-lasting PTSD, 1 month is a good benchmark to think about. So it's not normal for her to be terrified to be out alone in public. And I think it's time, if it's been a month at least, to find a good therapist and get some help with that.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's very wise advice. And again, thank you to the person who sent this question in. You know, we realize that these are very difficult times, and so you know, again, if you know, I would take heed to what the doctor is saying, and also now you have things on your website, so if they're not ready yet to look for counseling or whatever, are there things on the website or things in the book that you feel could also be beneficial?
Things parents can do on their own, definitely we talk about in the book at the end of every chapter. There are a special section of things for parents to do. It's kind of a recap and bullet points of advice. Particular things in this situation, I think the parent should accept that that's where the child is at. If she doesn't want to go out in public, don't make her, don't force her, don't make her feel like she's a failure because she can't do it. We've seen, you know, a case where children have been injured and then afraid to go do things again, and their parents have been kind of harsh on them and say, oh, come on, you just need to buck up, you know, be stronger. Well, if they could buck up and be stronger, they would have done that already. And so if this parent can be patient, allow her child to do what she needs to do to feel safe, that's what I think she needs to do. She could think about ways that might help her child feel safer, kind of have a safety plan. You know, each case is different, so it's hard to come up with a plan specifically for this listener's child. But ask the child, you know, what can we do to help you feel safer in this situation, and then we can do that.
You know, one of the things that as we're talking about the book is I had the feeling at times as I was reading it that, and I'm also a parent, And at times I was thinking of it as, you know, as a parent would, but at other times I was feeling that it was, you know, I was thinking of it more as a professional. And I'm thinking, okay, well, yeah, this is something that I want us to add to the next training that we have with our staff. When you were writing it, what was your thought process? Were you thinking more towards something that would go out to parents or to professionals?
It's really written for parents, most of all, because they're the ones who have the children to deal with in their homes. But I think it is also appropriate for professionals. I have tried to pack a lot of science and research and tips in there in ways that can be understood for people that are interested in the science and research part of it, too. I think it's a great book for trainees who are just learning about this in college or master's level programs. I think it can be good for grown-ups who were traumatized as children and maybe don't have children of their own but want to understand more about themselves and what they've gone through.
Well, that's a great point. Well, we have another question coming in. And again, I want to thank everybody. This tells us that, you know, we have hit a topic that that is hitting home for a lot of people. This one reads, I served in Afghanistan for 2 years and returned with a mild case of PTSD. Describing what this has been like, accepting the trauma and actually getting help was a challenge in itself, as I was brought up with the opinion that this type of a condition was a weakness in character. We have a teenage son, and it never occurred to me until now that his hot-headedness and stressful interactions with the rest of us might be a form of PTSD. We assumed that it was raging teen hormones. Thank you so much for shining the light on this topic, as I do think we need to read your book and help him accordingly. And this is from Joseph in California.
Joseph makes some good points. I think one of those is that people feel like they can't tell other people about what they've been through. Sounds like maybe after his war experiences, he didn't feel like he could talk to anybody about it. And I think I tell a story in the very first chapter of a teenage girl who felt exactly like that. She had been sexually assaulted. And that's not something you can just go talk to your friends about at the lunch table at school. And and that's where we get the title from the book. This girl was telling her therapist, she says, I'm never going to be the same after what I went through, and I can't tell anybody about it. And maybe that's how this Army veteran felt. You know, how does he talk to his wife about these things? And he should realize it's not just a weakness. It is, you know, he's just unfortunate, perhaps, that he had a genetic vulnerability to develop PTSD. And, you know, however he is, that's a strength for him in some areas. Unfortunately, it may have been a weakness that helped, you know, allowed him to develop PTSD in this sense. But it's not a moral weakness. It's not a psychological weakness. It's more of a genetic weakness kind of thing.
And do you find that that sort of attitude is greater in males than in females?
Probably. You know, men, our culture is to not talk about our feelings and buck up and deal with things. And, you know, there are more women who seek out help at psychiatric clinics than men. But men should know that it's okay to talk about it and get help for these things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. If you had one piece of advice for parents of children with PTSD, what would that be? The one thing, the number one takeaway that you would like people to come away with, what would you want to say?
It's up to you now. We have good professionals out there in psychology, psychiatry, social work fields, but they're just not trained well enough most of the time, and they're just not active enough in identifying trauma and doing the right kinds of treatment. So by de facto, it's up to parents. And that's kind of okay. Parents, there's a lot parents can do. They can get questionnaires. They can do self-assessments. They can ask the right questions. They can find the right kinds of therapies. But they're going to have to do some of the work.
Well, I like that. Yeah, it's, you know, let's make sure that we are controlling our own destiny from that standpoint. So I appreciate that. One of the things that many people that listen to the show, that when they comment on it, they say one of their favorite parts is the happy ending stories. If you could share a story or two that might be your favorite of situations that someone that you've dealt with, obviously we're not using any names, but someone you've dealt with and you came away feeling like, yes, that's where there was a huge turnaround.
I can think of several, and those are the stories that keep you going every year doing
Absolutely.
These kinds of things.
Absolutely.
you just need one good one a year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the girl I talked about earlier who had been sexually assaulted, she was going through a horrible time dealing with it and the post-traumatic stress, but she was able to turn it around into a positive. There's actually a phenomenon called post-traumatic growth, where people take bad things that happen to them and figure out a way to grow from it. This girl formed a rape awareness group in her high school to help other people, other girls, either prevent what happened to her or have a place to talk about it that hadn't existed before. So she used her experience to help others. Another case I think about is I'm in New Orleans, so a lot of the children I've studied were from Hurricane Katrina. And I can think of one boy in particular who was caught in a flooded house and then became terrified of all sorts of water and rain. He was only 4 years old. And his parents helped him through the cognitive behavioral treatment and helped him become kind of desensitized to water. And this mom, as part of the therapy, what we call exposure exercises, where you have to do things with the child on purpose to make them anxious so they can use their new coping skills to master their feelings about it. She took him back to their old house that had been flooded and took him up into the attic where they had spent two horrible, humid, hot, scary nights during Hurricane Katrina, and sat with him in this dirty old attic so that he can do his exposure exercises. And every time I think of that story, I think that's the perfect story of how therapy works and the perfect story of how a parent can help their child and help him get over these scary thoughts that he has.
Now, share a little bit in regards to, you know, why that type of therapy works in some instances and why it would never be used in other instances. Because and that, again, I think because we're talking to parents primarily, you know, and saying, you know, here are some things. But at the same time, I think they also need to know that this isn't a one-size-fits-all situation.
Yeah, it works. You know, what I call that exposure therapy, it works because the person has to be re-engaged with the traumatic memories somehow for them to master their feelings about it. It's kind of like the no pain, no gain philosophy. It sounds kind of cruel in a way that we have to re-expose people on purpose to their traumatic memories, but that's the way they get better most of the time. And if it's done in a gradual way and in a controlled way with new coping skills in place, then it doesn't make people worse. It usually works out for the best. You know, for 75% of people who do this kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, they get pretty good improvement.
All right. And then, so give us an example of one that is using a different therapy, another success story.
Well, there's another type of therapy called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy which doesn't depend on the exposures so much in real life. It's more done in an office-based and having people remember and visualize their traumatic memories. And that can work well for people who can't go back to the actual place where their trauma happened. And they can work with it just in the office setting.
Well, I got to tell you, doctor, I think is just such a huge subject. It's a huge topic right now, and I'm just so appreciative that you're out there. So again, for everybody out there, the book is They'll Never Be the Same, A Parent's Guide to PTSD in Youth and Treating PTSD in Preschoolers. It's a clinical guide. And I assume it can be gotten anywhere. Is that correct?
It should be at all your local bookstores. But if it's not, of course, you can always go to Amazon.com.
Okay. And if anybody would like to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you or to reach you?
I'm pretty easy to find on the internet. If you just Google my name, you'll probably find a website of me at Tulane University School of Medicine. You can find my email there on my website. I don't hide it. It's MSCHEER at Tulane.edu.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. And again, for everybody out there, if you feel that you have a child that has gone through this, get the book, check it out, see if there's some things that you can do. But also, if you know somebody, that's, I think, the other thing. And I have found it's just been a blessing that I get the ability to talk with these people and to learn more about what's going on, and which also means that I get the book as well. And I have found one of the greatest feelings that I've had is that when I meet somebody that starts telling me about a particular story, and I go, you know what, I think I have the book that you can read that will help, or point them in a direction. I think that's one of the things that we can all do and continue to spread the good news. So again, thank you so much. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, when our guest will be Karina Chakana to discuss the new book, You Play the Girl. This book is on Playboy Bunnies, Stepford Wives, Train Wrecks, and other mixed messages. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and together we'll make a positive difference in others. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check it out. If you like what you see, if you like what you read, please comment, spread it to others. That's the way that we can all make a positive difference. For everybody out there, be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.